Ladies and gentlemen, good evening, and hello to our viewers on Shore TV. Welcome to this special session of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs session. I'm Trevor Page, your moderator. First, I'd like to just address a few housekeeping matters. And I'd like to thank the Lethbridge Public Library for the use of this venue. It really gives SAGPA the possibility to expand the number of people that we can extend our debates to, other than the regulars that come along to our Thursday session. So we're grateful to the library. We would also like to acknowledge our partners, Shore TV, the University of Lethbridge, the Lethbridge Herald. And, you know, the media brings these debates into the homes of thousands of people in southern Alberta, so we consider that partnership extremely important. To encourage greater participation in these debates, I want to tell you just a couple of things about our new website, which is www.sagpa, that's S-A-C-P-A, .ca. First, courtesy of Shore TV, all of our sessions from September this year onwards are available in audio on the website. So although we would prefer people, obviously, to come along to the sessions in person, if you can't make it, or if you can't get a question in at a session, there may not be enough time, or perhaps you prefer to do it in the privacy of your own home, you can now participate in the debate on the website. What you have to do is open up the website and then go to the session that you're interested in. Go down to the bottom of the page and you'll see a line which is entitled Comment on this session. Click on that and you can post your comment or question on the session. Just down by that line, there's another line which says view comments of others. So you can see what other people are commenting on the website. So we would really encourage the use of this facility. As many of you know, SAGPA is funded totally by voluntary contributions from the public. My colleague, Jill Kopkas, is there to collect donations, and anything you contribute, of course, would be gratefully received. And now to this evening's debate. The Return of the Trojan Horse, Alberta and the New World Disorder. It's an original composition of critical essays about Alberta's policies. It's written by some of Alberta's and Canada's best authors, and we're very proud that we have three of them here this evening to present the book. Trevor Harrison, who also edited the book, Greg Flanagan, and Jim Byrne. All currently teach at the U of L. But Trevor is a professor of sociology and a former research director of the Parkland Institute. He's a frequent commentator on political events, both provincially and nationally. Subject of his talk this evening is the Klein Revolution and Alberta's Democratic Deficit. Greg Flanagan is assistant dean in the Faculty of Management at the U of L and a public finance economist. He will be speaking about Alberta's finances. Jim Byrne is a professor of geography. He's heavily involved in the impact of climate change on water resources in the western part of North America. He will be presenting an extract of his video, Fire Underwater, which has been telecast nationally. After the presentations, which we think will take about an hour in total, that is, we'll break for 10 minutes for coffee. And then we'll reconvene for a question and answer session. And at the coffee break and after the session, I'd like to tell you that the book, The Return of the Trojan Horse, is on sale. It's on sale at a special price of $25, and the authors have very generously offered to give SAGPA $5 for every book sold this evening. So we encourage you all to buy books, not just for yourselves, but Christmas presents, etc., etc. So with that, we'll get on to the presentation, and let me invite Trevor Harrison to the podium.
Oh, it was very daring of you to clap before you've even heard me speak. Thank you. And thank you, Trevor, for the very nice introduction. Well, I'm going to hopefully be provocative and interesting for you this evening, and also mercifully short, so that we have some time to discuss afterwards. I'm going to be talking about Alberta's democratic deficit for the most part. There are many things coming out of the Klein Revolution that people are probably going to remember over the years. Certainly one of the things that the government itself likes to talk about is having dealt with the deficit and debt problems that were facing Alberta in the early point of the 1990s. But it seems to me that in the long run, one of the things that is going to be the most marked consequence of the Klein Revolution and the Klein years is really a deterioration of democratic institutions and the practice of democracy in this province. You know, one of the things that is most striking about looking at Alberta and Canadian politics over the last while is some really genuine concern expressed towards politicians in general, and certainly towards Ottawa and the federal government. And we all know, of course, the great discord that is going on around the scandal, and there should be. People should be concerned about the spending and some of the contracts that were given out. These are serious things to be to consider. At the same time, in an almost kind of perverse way, there is one thing you can actually say about what's gone on in Ottawa over the last while. That is, to a large extent, what you're seeing in Ottawa, as messy as it is democracy in action. The fact is, somebody found out about those contracts. People are going to go to jail. Money is going to be repaid. And hopefully things are actually going to be addressed in a way that those kinds of scandals don't happen again. Although, let's keep in mind here, we have a long history of scandals going back over 100 years. But effectively, what you see going on in Ottawa, as messy as it is really democracy in action. Now, the really interesting thing is, of course, and the Premier said only a few days ago, you know, if those kind of things ever happened in Alberta, I'd be run out of town, or hung, or tarred and feathered, or something. I can't remember the exact language. I suspect there's more than a few people who chuckled at that, because the simple fact is you'd never find out in Alberta. Democracy does not function here. The system does not function in a way to find out those things. I can alert you to the fact that, and the Auditor General over the last number of years has alerted us in various reports saying there's something wrong here. Something smelled about something that happened here, but the Auditor General doesn't have a mandate to go any further than that. The Auditor General can't point fingers. The Auditor General cannot go about prosecuting. And that's the end of it. That's the end of what whiff of scandal we ever see in this province. And you will never find out many of the things, even though a lot of people have suspicions. There are, I will say, in the last couple of weeks following the Premier's remarks, there has been, in fact, a couple of articles that have talked about this, and I will give some accolades here, in fact, to the Lethbridge Herald, that on Thursday, November 3rd, actually had Pot Quick to Throw Barbs Kettles Way. That's kind of the most awkward title I've ever seen for a while. But they're alerting us to the fact that things, you know, that are that Ottawa is accused of doing, the same sort of things seem to happen in Alberta, but people walk away from it. More recently, Ricardo Acuna, who's the executive director of Parkland Institute, wrote an extremely good article, actually, in the Edmonton Journal, talking about the fact that, for example, the Canadian Association of Journalists awarded the Klein government their annual Code of Silence Award, recognizing the most secretive government body in Canada. something that the textbook will I'll plumb for it here, actually talks about in terms of the control of the media in this province. Well, I've got a list here of just a few short things that both these articles and other people have pointed out. They're at least somewhat suspicious, and that Albertans should, in a functioning democracy, be concerned about. A contract for $400,000 to a friend of then Health Minister Gary Marr for apparently little work. The undocumented use of government airplanes, land giveaways in the north, in the Fort McMurray region, that the Auditor General has termed questionable, costing Albertans money while rewarding friends and financial supporters of the area's government minister, free dinners for lobbyists, that's just a few of the things these articles mention. There's other things as well over the years that Albertans should be questioning. The selling off of government liquor stores to government insiders, having been involved in two of these reports, and Greg was involved in second one, and wrote it, it was somewhat questionable at the time the way that privatization occurred here. Privatization of CKUA, the people's radio station, which rewarded government friends again. The workings of Workers' Compensation Board, the contracting out of health services in Calgary, the low royalty rates on oil and gas that may have cost Alberta as much as $35, $36 billion. The Alberta Securities Commission and the ongoing concerns around that. Or contracts given for highway maintenance, where it's not quite clear that, in fact, a good deal has been gained in outsourcing this work. Beyond that, one of the most striking things that occurs to me in the last few days is the Premier's comments regards the fact that the $7 billion in surplus money, and let's keep in mind here, Alberta's $7 billion is only about $3 billion short of what the federal government is going to run. So we're talking big bucks. That $7 billion in surplus has now been spent. It's allocated all over the place, but the legislature hasn't sat to even talk about it. And the Premier's comment in regards to this is, well, the legislature only should have, has comments or concerns or can discuss budgeted amounts. It has no say over unbudgeted amounts, which is the surplus. Now, the word slush fund comes to mind, but when you start to talk about $7 billion, it seems to me that's a tad more than your usual slush fund. We're talking about a huge amount of money that is appropriated by the government in power to spend however it wants, without any kind of oversight. Treating what is effectively Albertans' money as their money. But there's also something even more profoundly interesting about the way government actually operates in this province today. I used to say that we lived in a one-party state, but we don't. It's actually much worse than that. We live in a one-person state. Because, in fact, even I don't think most of the Tory cabinet ministers any longer have a say over what goes on. The Premier just simply, on a whim, says, tuitions. I think I'll freeze them. They're frozen. I think that we will give money to this. It happens. A commission a while ago, just a few weeks ago, came forward with a recommendation that Alberta should have a lobbyist registry. I'm not sure in the long run this would be terribly curtail the workings of lobbyists working over government ministers, but it would add to transparency. The committee, in any case, came forward and said, Alberta should think about having a lobbyist registry. The Premier's immediate response was, I don't think it's a good idea. And that's the end of it. It's buried. It's done. It's finished. There will never be a lobbyist registry because the Premier said so. What is astonishing is not just that Albertans as a whole seem totally uninterested in any of these things that go on. What is perhaps even more perversely interesting is there is no one in the Tory party who apparently would ever stand up and say, the Emperor has no clothes. Enough is enough. This is not a one-party state. Well, there have been a few people over the years who have suggested that Alberta's, I would say sick, but it's worse than sick democracy, needs some help. A number of us have suggested things over the years that I think would remedy what is going on. But much of this has to be can't proceed without Albertans at large actually saying they want it. Albertans getting out there and demanding these changes. I'll read off a few. At the end of our book, what we did, this actually was a sequel to a book that came out 10 years ago that I co-edited with Gordon Laxer. This time around, we actually put in a set of recommendations at the back, at least to further discussion, on a whole range of things. Well, we had one section on just political institutions. I'll read off what we suggested as possible solutions. First of all, I think we need to adopt a new electoral system based on proportional representation in the legislature. The fact is, the governing parties always through the system in this province, in every province, and federally, are disproportionately rewarded. With less than 50% of the vote, the Conservative Party ended up with 70%, 75% of the seats last time around. This happens all the time. I have to say here, it's not just Alberta has changed it, all of Canada has to change this, and a lot of other places are actually looking at these changes. BC had a referendum on electoral reform looking for a new electoral system. Everybody, or most provinces across this province, across this country, are looking for solutions. New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Quebec has talked about it, BC has talked about it. Alberta, no discussion whatsoever about changing that. Fundamentally, I think all of Canada has to change the electoral system. We probably do, as has been suggested, need to adopt a system of fixed four-year election dates, so the governments in power can't finagle that. Eliminate corporate and union political contributions. One of the things that one of the chapters I write about in this text actually looks at political contributions from corporations, particularly to the various parties. Clearly, the governing party has a huge amount of those contributions. Place increased restrictions on individual political contributions as well. And along with this, place increased restrictions on third-party spending during elections, because, if you take the money out of directly influencing elections, people can at the same time indirectly do so through large amounts of money as well. Create all-party standing committees, something which Alberta does not have, but most other provinces do. And among the first duties of such an all-party standing committee would be a review of the purpose of and funding for the Public Affairs Bureau, that notorious kind of Pravda-like organization that has about 250 people that sucks up huge amounts of money to basically tell us what it thinks we should know. A review of FOIP laws to ensure that it is providing reasonable access at reasonable cost to government documents or to obtain government documents. We have freedom of information legislation here, as most places do. It doesn't work terribly well in a lot of places. It particularly doesn't work well at all in Alberta because you have to know exactly what you're looking for. If you don't, you're going to spend an awful lot of money, and I mean a lot of money, getting blank paper or things you didn't need in any case. And also a review of Alberta's current royalty rates on oil and gas, which a number of reports have suggested are significantly below what other jurisdictions are charging. Reduce the number of MLAs and redistribute the remaining seats. Alberta actually has a large, large number of MLAs. It actually gets very difficult to keep track of them. The only time you actually hear the names of some of them, and I actually sat on the CBC election desk last year, and I had to kind of prompt myself a few days before trying to know who these people were. I'd never heard of some of these people, because you never do hear them, except election time, and then you find out they're being elected for the third and fourth time. In any case, we have an awful lot of MLAs, and it's not quite sure what they actually do, but we also have real problems in redistribution in this province. Create a lobbyist registry, which, as I said, the Premier has already said is a no-go, but one can always hope. Enact comprehensive whistleblower legislation for both the government and private sector. This has actually been mentioned just in the last few days by the head of AUPE. And again, most jurisdictions have something like this, and there have been any number of cases federally, other provinces that we know about, that where it's important that in order for people to come out and speak about things they think are wrong, they have to have some kind of protection. Civil servants in Alberta don't have that, neither do people in the private sector. So those were a number of, again, I hope, provocative and sufficiently interesting recommendations of how I think we could begin to reset the ship of state in this province, to get it going in a direction that is more democratic and more functional for the future. The last thing I'll say is that this is not just simply a matter of getting it right around democracy. It's not just so that we can vote every few years and have some sense that people are doing what we ask them to do. This affects every aspect of our lives. And it's tied up inevitably with things about budget decisions. As Greg is going to talk to you shortly about, the fact is budgets, how money is spent, the things that are spent on or not spent on, these are fundamentally issues of democracy as well. And finally, as Jim is going to be talking about as well, the whole issue of democracy is also tied up whether or not each and every one of us has a say in the kind of environment, the kind of social life, the kind of communities, the kind of province that we're going to have in future. Thank you.
Short, right? Academics are hard to keep short, so we'll try and keep it short. Anyway, it's a pleasure to be here, and I thank the group for inviting me and having me in the session here today. I did want to put a little plug in for the book. I read it this weekend. Had some time for first time in a while. The process is usually you contribute your chapter, and so you don't see the other chapters as they're being delivered. So it's the first time I've had a chance to really look at the book. I would say everybody should be looking at this. I think it's a really important piece of work in Alberta at this time, and I'll allude to some of the reasons why I think this is probably the only way you can really get some good information on what's happening politically. And accolades to Trevor, because it was really Trevor with all his energy putting it together as an editor. It's one thing to write the piece, but it's also good to have somebody chasing you down. But to put it together into a whole and make it a whole work is really a huge amount of work. And I know Trevor, as an academic, doesn't even get much credit for this kind of thing, because we like to add up journal articles and so on that two or three people might read. So I really see this. He's just done a great public service in providing this kind of information in a collection. The author's writing's excellent, excepting maybe my chapter. It's pretty boring when I read it, and I think that's supported by at least one review where there was accolades for everyone, but nonetheless, I'm going to make a few points here on the chapter. Just an anecdote before I get started. Last time I spoke in this theater was 11 or 12 years ago, and I was invited down to Lethbridge. I was at Calgary at Mount Royal College, and I was invited down to present some data on the deficit and debt, because if for many of you, you'll remember back then, those are the issues, and they've been the issues now for a decade. So to me, it's absolutely remarkable to see how that has been, the driving force of this particular political regime and where it looks for all of its accolades for success. At the time, I went through, just finished a textbook in first year economics, so I was kind of very much teaching first year economics and walked through the notions of deficit and debt and net debt and surpluses and tried to make that all clear. Deficit being, the annual difference between the expenditures and the revenues when the expenditures are greater. The debt being the accumulated amount, which is what you heard a lot at that time. I don't know if you remember that period. In fact, at the time, I would have argued we maybe had a serious debt problem nationally, but we had nothing serious in Alberta. We did have a deficit that was a signal that we were certainly heading for some difficulty if we didn't either increase our revenues or reduce our expenditures at the time. What happened to me was very interesting, and it alludes back to having a book where there's some information. Reporters came up and asked me to go over some details, and the next day I'm in the front of the Lethbridge Herald with a statement, Calgary Economist says there's no deficit. So I had made very clear the deficit was serious and a signal, but the accumulated debt was not a big deal. So, of course, some of my colleagues wondered what I was out there doing. I racked it up to maybe some incompetence or not listening to the reporter's case, but it certainly didn't look good to be having said something that was so patently wrong. Alberta Report subsequently got a hold of that. They called me. Now, what they did was quite unprofessional. And it was the first kind of interaction I had with Alberta Report at that time. And they did a big piece which was so fabricated to put down anything I had to say and, of course, twist the whole argument. So it was a lesson to learn, and it just tells me where, you know, the public's getting their information in many cases and believing this stuff. So one of my themes here is a caution to where you get your information. I suppose on a positive note, I figured that I was clearly dangerous. This information was dangerous. So gave me a little bit of, stimulus to pursue some of the research and where I've been going. On that note, before I get into some of the major, I'm just going to show you, this comes from that communist organization, Stats Canada. And if you see down here in 1993-94, when I was presenting this data and Alberta government data, we had about a $9 billion, the red line and dots, we had about a $9 billion accumulated net debt. Not a figure you heard in any of the elections at the time. Put $9 billion in perspective, our surplus is likely to be $9 billion this year alone. So not exactly a major problem to get too upset about. You can see that the deficits were running pretty high there in the blue dots, blue squares, in those years. So we're -3, -4, roughly in that range. And obviously, if you stayed on that trend, you're going to get into significant trouble. This was the result of a recession in the 90s, late 80s and 90s in Alberta. Again, some of you can remember that. So things were not exactly very strong economically. But all the signals, and the government that came into power, Klein's government, was well aware of all the signals that the economy was on a major upturn in Alberta. So all we had to do, from a rational perspective, was carry on doing things, possibly trimming a little bit more. Getty had actually been trimming expenditures and tightening up to a degree that was reasonable under the circumstances. Much of this deficit in those periods came from an over-exuberant investment in private enterprise by the government, the MAGCAMs and those kind of operations that lost $20 billion in total. So a lot of that was from that. Cut that out and you're automatically going to improve your situation. You got an upturn in the economy and of course you start to see the deficits turned very quickly into surpluses. Of course, those were on top of or are partially due to the massive cuts that occurred out of the mid-90s program. So that's a pretty important graph. You see that in 1999 we were debt-free, and then subsequently we've been building up an accumulated surplus, and that's going to be added to amazingly this year. Now, the reason this gets confused, and you can go into the details in the book, I'll sell the book again here, is because we had a bank account that we put away, the Heritage Trust Fund and other accounts, and we had liabilities, we float bonds, and we financed current activities through those bonds. And so people could talk about the debt, and they were talking about the gross debt, that is what was owed. So it's like you putting money away in a savings account for your future, your RSP for your pension, and of course you have a mortgage, and really what we're interested in, to see how well off you are, is your net worth. And net debt is like net worth. So Alberta was never, ever in any particular fiscal problem. Certainly there was some signal there. Some things had to be acted on. And as I've said, if we cut out some of that kind of investment that wasn't going anywhere, we would have dealt with that. So one thing to consider here is that we're still hearing, you know, we had grand, you know, signing away of debts with Klein and other politicians to show that the great goal was achieved just recently. Even, of course, it was achieved a long time ago. We still have, you know, you don't hear them saying this, we still have some $20 billion worth of debt out there. If you want to talk about the paper, and much of that debt isn't coming due till 2025. It's just now they talk net debt because it's a net surplus, you see. So it's just the way you play with the numbers. So anyway, I learned a few things, Tenor. I don't know if they've served me much good, but it's going to be, I hope, an interesting election coming up. So more and more of this will get out. Okay, public finance, which is really what I'm into, and that's really the balancing the, you know, deciding what to spend on from the public perspective and how to get the revenue to do that. Public finance is an area that really takes the perspective. It starts traditionally in a sense that a market is the culture we're in. So whatever the market does well, we're fine with. But what a public finance economist recognizes, or the discipline recognizes, there's a lot of failures in using a market for various activities. So this is not a radical approach. It's just recognition that we need to interact. And of course, where you see the big government expenditures in health and education and environment and transportation and communications and social assistance and so on are really the result of the failures of just individually interacting in the marketplace. And so recognizing that, we act and we look to the social good in doing that. So from a public finance perspective, we should see in a mature, sophisticated political economy, we should see a pretty stable expenditure pattern. Clearly there's ups and downs at the margins depending on the particular parties in power, particular attitudes by populations at a particular time. But we shouldn't see, you know, huge variations, and you don't in most jurisdictions. Doesn't, you know, when regimes change, you don't see the whole thing thrown in disarray. So that would be the first point I'd make. Then usually you decide that from those relatively objective, analytical kind of points of view. And obviously there's discussion, there's debate, and there's politics there. Then there's a realm where you really can only bring yourself so far, and you're into the political. And that depends on what we as a society want to do, what our vision is. And that will change to a degree, and that's going to push certain things in certain ways. But once establishing that, then the trick from that point of view is to raise the revenues to do those things. And that is, we want to raise the revenues in the most efficient way, and in a fair and equitable way. So what we've seen in Alberta in 10 years is a reversal of that perspective. We came into this, said we're going to cut everything. We devastated, and I'll use that word, we devastated the public sector in those mid-90s. We took 20%, and when you work in the details, more like 22% out of the system. The system had already been tightening up and reducing inefficiencies to the degree there were, and it was not there to take out. Part of it came out in public service wages, and we lost a huge amount there. We saw teachers quit because they could go and make more money selling coffee in a coffee house. You know? But it wasn't just the money, but it was quite the insult to the public service. It was saying, you guys are lazy, you're not doing your job, what you do is useless, we're going to cut you out. And that's what I think really hurt the public service. So we took that all out, and then we found very quickly that we just could not provide those level services, the basic level services that had to be provided. So then we pumped a whole bunch more in, and we had to pay a lot more in order to overcome the damage. And so we see that way. So instead of a nice kind of stable, I'm just going to give you some pictures of this. You know, there's a good example of the kind of wave form we're seeing. When you take another jurisdiction or you take some of our federal programs, they might have a little jockeying around when they're introduced until they find a stability, and then pretty much they're stable. Now, there's some important points here that I want to bring forward when you're looking at data. When I opened the Herald one morning, Calgary Herald, and there is front page again in, 48-point print. Climate says care spending is out of control. It's over 100% increased in the last decade. And see, there's nothing wrong with that fact from the point of view if you take the dollars spent in 1995 and the dollars spent in 1985, the 1995 were twice as much as the 1985. So you can get away with that kind of a statement. I was very disappointed that a journalist wouldn't be more educated and do at least a critique of those numbers. But I quickly, because I have the data at hand, pump those numbers in. And what do? I've got to, first of all, take out the inflationary factor. We want constant dollars. We want to compare with the same measuring stick. There was a fair amount of inflation over that 10-year period. And then, of course, health services expenditures is got to be somehow related to the population. So you do it per capita. When I did that calculation, in fact, healthcare expenditures had not changed much at all. They were down a few percentage points probably within the measure of error. So it hadn't changed in 10 years. So again, the use of the language, the use of the data, very misleading, but very effective in then smashing the healthcare sector. So anyway, this kind of thing is in constant dollars per capita, and you get these nice waveforms in Alberta because of the way we've been running this province. Keith Brownsey in one of the chapters talks about, and he states boldly, and I can't disagree, that we've had such strong oil and gas revenues, far less than they should be, as Trevor points out, but very strong compared to our population, that this government's been able to mask all of its really inability to manage the public funds. And yet they come out, and the rhetoric is they're looking very good because they've solved the debt problem, and look at all the money they got to spend, and so on and so forth. So we've really actually been very unwise in what we've done, smacking the public service and then having to rebuild it because of the need. Now you see we're actually up in 2004, we're up higher per capita than we ever were. And now one of the reviewers who liked all the chapters in the book, except mine, Edmonton journalist, was critical of me because I didn't smack the government for spending too much now. And of course, I'm coming from the perspective, well, really what they've been doing is bringing it back up to where in this objective kind of sense of what we have to do in the public sector for the right reasons, because it's the best economic and social thing to do, has cost us money to bring us back up. So that wasn't my perspective. Now, a year later, I'm thinking that she's right. Because now we're going to go over the top here again in this. And I can't figure it out. We're pouring more money in this year into health, and at the same time, they want to privatize it. Well, you can't figure out where they're going, because what would there be left to privatize the way the money's flowing in this year? And I'm going to have to come around full circle and have to criticize the government in the next piece I do about overspending. So it's kind of ironic. But now they got the money, they don't know what to do with it. Okay? Election year coming up, I guess they pour it out. So we're in a very strange state. So I want you to watch for the kind of data you see, and I hope that's what you get out of my chapter. Note the kind of things that have been going on. Note this is one of the more desperate kind of things in Alberta, is that we're coming up and even going overboard in the education area, the health area, and so on, so such and such areas, transportation, communications. But our social assistance is still. So we have a somewhat, mean attitude to those in need in this province. And we do that two ways. One is we've cut the social assistance, but we've also flattened the tax in this province so that we've lost progressivity and we're really releasing the responsibility of some of the more wealthy in the tax that they should be paying. And again, pretty conventional economics that progressive income tax is the way to get people who have the means and who have benefited most by the society they live in to pay proportionally somewhat more towards the system. And we've been taking that out of the system as well. So we've got, you know, decreased taxes, corporate and personal, more user fees, levies, our health premiums were bumped up. We're now relying on, just look at this little picture there. We're allowing on gaming profits to run more and more of the province. Look at Alberta compared to the rest of the nation in gaming profits. So we're kind of twisted on both sides. We're twisted on our revenue, and we're twisted on our expenditures. So I think I'll just wrap up there. I just wanted to show you a few figures. Oh no, there was one other thing I wanted to show you here to give you perspective. This will give you a bit of perspective of where we were in 1993. So we had total revenue per capita was 237 more than the rest of the jurisdiction summed up. Our expenditures were 589 more than the provincial means excluding Alberta. So these figures at the top right-hand corner there. In 2004, our revenue per capita is $1,500 more per person. That's in an environment with the lowest tax regime, $1,500 more, and our expenditures per capita are $42 more. So we've kind of meaned out there in terms of our expenditures. Remember that these are after this rise, you know, back to the levels of the late 80s. We're at $42 more, but our revenues per capita are way up. So I guess to some, we never really had a fiscal problem, and what we did is we did a lot of damage in the process of addressing a problem that didn't exist. We'll stop there. Thank you very much.
We're going to have a very quick break right now because it's going to take 5 minutes for Jim to set up the projector so we can watch his video. So a 5 minute break now. We will have another one before the question and answer session, and the next one will be after the end of the video. So please help yourselves to coffee.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. I'm going to enjoy talking to you about our water and fire TV series and some of the issues going on with natural resource management in Alberta.
I'm going to enjoy standing in front of the microphone even more. So I'm going to talk about water under fire for you tonight and some of the issues that we see as really problematic in terms of water in Canada, water in Alberta. I'm going to focus on Alberta, but water under fire, Fergus here in the front worked with me on this series, George Gallant, Rick Mrazek. You know, we had a wonderful time and it was an amazing opportunity to go around the country and meet with Canada's best water scientists and get their perspective on issues. As a water scientist, and most of you, some of you know me, I've been involved in this field for 20 years, I had no idea, I wouldn't have fathomed that Canada has done so much put our water in such a terrible state in so many places. It was wonderful to learn about it. It also put me in a very interesting position of, you know, just how far to push some of this, and I guess we're just going to keep pushing it because I think, you know, as First Nation elders have shared in the past, they say we don't inherit the earth from our parents, we borrow it from our children. And right now we're not doing a very good job of protecting it for our children. So I'm going to take you across the country, or actually just across the province in this case. If we had more time, we could go all across the country, because it's really 3.5 hours of television. We shot, what, Ferg, about 30 or 40 hours of 70 hours maybe? Yeah, of interviews in total with scientists, and we got the best of the best in water under fire. So this is the TV series. We're going to take a trip from the southern mountains in and around the southern Rockies. That's where we're going to start. We're going to trip up to the oil sands, and then we're going to end up in the Northwest Territories looking at gold mining. And I'm just going to add a few words in each between each clip to get to kind of set the scene. This first clip is taking us into the Rocky Mountains and looking at water issues in the Rocky Mountains. So let's go first.
Hello, I'm Bob McDonald. On this episode of Water Under Fire from the Rockies... we look at the mighty Fraser River and the beautiful Okanagan Valley. Water Under Fire is a coast-to-coast investigation of the real threats facing Canada's... The Saskatchewan River system begins in the Rocky Mountains with meltwater from the Bow Glacier in Banff National Park. Nothing seems more pure than glacial water, but as you're about to find out, it ain't necessarily so.
I think most people would expect that this would be a pretty pristine setting. However, that's not what a 1993 survey of fishes by Environment Canada showed that levels of toxaphene and DDT and other contaminants were unusually high for lakes anywhere.
Schindler began to study Bow Lake after the fish in this subalpine environment in the middle of a national park were so contaminated that Health Canada had concerns about people eating them. The problem was in the ice. Each winter, a new layer of snow and ice forms on the glacier. The layers are called strata. While they're forming, contaminants from the other side of the world, carried by wind currents, are deposited on the glacier when they hit cold air at high altitudes. Bomb fallout, volcanic ash, and industrial emissions are all part of the snowpack that eventually melts into the lake and gets into the food chain. Schindler studied the snowpack at different elevations to see how the contaminants were distributed.
We found that for most contaminants, things like toxaphene and DDT and PCBs, there was a great increase in the deposition with the increasing elevation. Then we got to thinking that these things were mostly used in larger amounts earlier on in the century, particularly DDT and toxaphene and PCBs. So we did a transect back through the layers and found that indeed, for most things, there was higher deposition back in the 1950s and 1960s.
Studies in the Sierra Nevada mountains and the Alps in Europe have shown nearly identical results to Bow Glacier. The same concentrations of contaminants are present at the same elevations, leading Schindler to conclude the poisons that come to rest in Alberta's Rockies have been falling on mountains the world over. Schindler believes it's not too late for people to make changes, but it can't happen soon enough.
The only thing we can do to change this pattern if these pollutants are truly coming across the oceans is by international treaty. And there are some attempts at that by international organizations around the northern hemisphere at present, but they're going at a, pardon the pun, but a glacial pace.
We leave Bow Glacier and travel further south to the headwaters of the Old Man River, another tributary of the South Saskatchewan River system. Here, Dan Fagray explains how continuing global changes are radically impacting this water supply.
In Glacier National Park, where I do a lot of my work, there used to be 150 glaciers. We're down to about 27 now, and many of these that were very large in size are reduced to less than one-third of their previous size. And this is really important for a lot of organisms that live downstream from glaciers, because glaciers provide the late summer base flow. This is the water that's still in the streams when all the snowpacks are gone and it's dry elsewhere. And furthermore, this is cold water, and many of these organisms need that cold water. So as the glaciers recede and shrink and disappear one by one, we'll see some profound changes in the water supply and the aquatic organisms that are dependent on those water supplies.
Annual snowfall in the mountains is changing too.
In fact, over the last 50 years, we've seen a pretty dramatic decline in the spring moisture content of the snowpacks and how early they melt out, and also how quickly. For instance, the initiation of stream flow in our area has also gotten earlier, so there's a more intense period of snow melt and flow from the mountains. And what that means is that there's less later on in the summer to nourish these streams and to provide downstream water users.
Scientists studying patterns in mountain snowpack say they're alarmed at what their research reveals with these rivers, the lifeblood of the prairies.
But in 2020 or 2050, we believe that the snowpacks in these alpine areas will have been reduced by as much as 40% on average. And that essentially means a close to 40% reduction in the water flow that we would expect in the Saskatchewan River system and other river systems like the North Saskatchewan, like the Athabasca, like the Missouri to the south.
So we're looking at substantial declines in our water supply in Alberta and south of the border, and changes in quality. It's amazing how now long-range transport of pollutants is affecting everyone, everywhere now, and changing how our environment is. In fact, the polar regions are heavily polluted because they're always cold, and they're a wonderful trap for volatile organic compounds traveling around in the Earth's circulation. We've also found more recent work, since Dave Schindler did this work in the 90s, more recent work has indicated that many farm chemicals, many chemicals from other emission sources end up as well in our alpine areas. In fact, during the farming season, during the summer season, about 50% of the time the winds are set up that they'll carry sprays from the prairies up into the alpine areas where they can be deposited again. The decline in stream flows, around 40%, by 2020 to 2050, we're already over-allocated in the South Saskatchewan River Basin. I should acknowledge my friend and colleague, Stephen Kinsler, who's sitting back there. He worked on this work with me. Susan Lapp was the graduate student who did some of that work, and Guy Duke also did quite a bit of that, too. We've just got a paper together now on the Okanagan, which we did a very similar analysis, very straightforward. This is not complex global circulation modeling. This is all well-established algorithms and well-established hydrology. We find about a 30% decline in the snowpack that's going to be available in the Okanagan Basin. So our water supplies are shrinking radically. We're polluting them with long-range transport. We're polluting them locally. We're creating some problems. And where I want to go now is actually to northern Alberta. There's lots of things we could talk about anywhere in Canada, but one in northern Alberta that particularly concerns me. This next clip is about the oil sands. So let's watch that one for a minute, okay?
The Athabasca River was born hundreds of miles south at the Athabasca Glacier. It's part of the Columbia Ice Fields in Jasper National Park. The foot of this glacier has receded steadily for the past 100 years, more than a kilometer and a half so far. The Athabasca River flows through the Athabasca oil sands in northern Alberta. The largest known deposits of crude oil in the world lies under one of the most pristine, undisturbed sections of boreal forest, the forest that grows in the northern hemisphere. The oil provides huge export revenues. Most of it, 70%, is being shipped to the U.S. one of Canada's foremost water experts, Dr. David Schindler, and wetlands expert, Dr. Suzanne Bailey, traveled with us for this episode of Water Under Fire.
We are a very wasteful generation. I think if any Canadian could overfly this area, as we all have, and see the price of filling the tank for his gas-guzzling SUV, he'd be buying a hybrid tomorrow.
Flying over the open pits demonstrates how everything here functions on a mammoth scale. Here are the current and planned oil sands projects. All combined, they cover over 25,000 square kilometers. That's just about as big as Lake Erie. With operations continuing around the clock, they're continually growing. The largest heavy hauler trucks carry 400 tons of unrefined oil sands. How big is that? Well, that's me standing beside the truck. Depending on the percentage of bitumen, it takes about 2 tons of oil sand to produce 1 barrel of synthetic crude. So, one load on one of these trucks produces about 200 barrels of oil. To extract enough bitumen to make 1 barrel of oil requires at least 3 barrels of water. Looking at this truck, to extract the 200 barrels of crude oil it's carrying will require 600 barrels of water. Most of this water is coming out of the Athabasca River. The extraction process uses water almost right to the end. After it's crushed at the mine site, the oil sand is mixed with warm water and pumped into the extraction plant through a pipeline. The process called hydrotransport also provides conditioning, breaking down the bonds that hold sand and bitumen together. From here, this oil sand slurry is fed into a primary separation vessel where more hot water is added. The slurry separates into sand at the bottom, middlings, which is a combination of bitumen and water, and bitumen froth above. Bitumen froth is scraped off the top. Solids and water are removed from the bitumen to purify it. The middlings go through a secondary extraction process, and the sand is pumped into the tailings pond.
What's behind us is one of the oil sands tailing ponds from one of the first two oil sands developments. From up here, it looks like good clean water, but in fact, stuff you wouldn't want to drink. Those booms you hear in the background aren't hunters. Those are propane-powered cannons that are trying to deter ducks from landing. They also have scarecrows on buoys in the middle of these things, wearing coveralls and park hats, because ducks that land there don't ever take off again.
At Shell Oil's Albion Sands plant, they say they're serious about environmental responsibility. The company takes the raw hydrocarbon or bitumen from the ground the same way other companies do, but that's where the similarities end. Engineers found a way to use the naturally occurring salty basal water in the refining process so it actually buffers the oil and reduces the amount of water needed for the river. They also work with a closed-loop system, meaning none of the contaminated water is dumped back into the Athabasca. Shell's already had the lease here for 50 years and is sitting on about 5 billion barrels of crude oil. The company's major challenge is finding cheaper ways to get it out of the ground while holding true to its promise to be a better steward of the land.
There are going to be some impact on the environment. You can't avoid that, but we can minimize that impact, and also we can work with our neighbors. If we're going to grow this business, we have to be able to deal with the cumulative environmental effects, because we're part of the problem. We have to be part of the solution, right?
We are working with other industry reps to understand where they withdraw water, to try to get a more realistic scenario of what the actual water withdrawals will be, because we always take very conservative assessments when we do our cumulative effects assessment. So we're trying to get the